Well, go ahead and open your Bibles to Song of Solomon. If you're not sure where it is, if you can find Psalms and Proverbs in the middle of your Bible and keep going to the right, you'll hit Ecclesiastes right after Proverbs and then Song of Solomon. We're going to be in Song of Solomon chapter 4 today. Before we actually read from Song of Solomon chapter 4, it would be really an honor for me if you would go ahead and kind of put your finger in Song of Solomon 4 when you get there and flip with me over to Genesis chapter 1. Verse 28, because today we are going to have, as the sermon is titled, a very honest discussion on biblical sex. And so before I do that, I want to kind of get your attention sort of turned to Genesis chapter 1 and show you something from there. Now, I want to go ahead and say this. Today is going to be very, very uncomfortable for some of you. Just the word sex itself, it sends you into a tizzy. Your face reddens up, you get all awkward and stressed, and you begin to nervously bite your nails because you're concerned about what I might be going to say next, right? So it's going to be hard for some of you. Some of you are going to have a hard time because, honestly, you're still fifth graders in health class, and you're like, you know, immaturely giggling with your buddies every time the teacher uses the medical name for the human reproductive organs, right? So you have a hard time doing that. So some of this is going to be really, really hard for some of you. But at the same time, this is important that we go through this. The fact is, you probably never heard a sermon probably just on the topic of sex and sex between a man and a woman in marriage. And so I want to go ahead and tell you, and this is the reason why I had you turn to Genesis chapter 1, that despite the fact that you've never heard a sermon that addressed the issue, the Bible never shies away from the issue or the topic of sex. As a matter of fact, the Bible doesn't just not shy away from sex, it actually sanctions it. And this is where I want to start you in Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. So if you'll just read with me for a second. And God blessed them. This is the creation of Adam and Eve. They've been created, and these are God's first words to them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." The first part of the verse is what's very important for us. And God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." Did you catch what just happened? Like, God creates Adam and Eve, and then like 2 seconds later, he's telling them to get busy consummating their marriage and repopulating the earth with babies by having sex. Like 2 seconds after he creates them, this is what God is doing, sanctioning the act of sex between a man and a woman in marriage. Please don't just gloss over that. I mean, think just for a second about what that means. God actually commands them to have sex. And so that would mean for Adam and Eve to not have sex would mean that they were being disobedient to the commands of God. And I think we can extrapolate that out and make a strong biblical argument that for a man and woman in marriage to not routinely and often be engaging in sexual intercourse is being disobedient to the commands of God that he gave men and women for marriage. And you don't have to like that. And I know there's a lot of ladies in the room. I'm just going to go ahead and say this. I'm off script already, and that's dangerous. But I know there are a lot of ladies in the room that you're tired of your husband begging you for more sex. And you need to know right off the bat that you are commanded by God. You are commanded by God to have sex with your husband. And to not do that means to be disobedient to God. Now, that means also the fact that God commands them to have sex. It also means that sex is from the mind of God. God is the one who came up with sex, not a man. And that seems kind of strange to us to think. I think further proof that God intends that we have sex with members of the opposite sex is that he created us with sexual organs. And God makes no mistakes, and he would not have created us with reproductive organs that match up so neatly unless he intended that we use them. But I need to say this. Not only does God sanction and intend that we have sex, he also intends that we enjoy it. Right? This is so strange to me. Most of church history, and I'm not talking about just the last 15 or 20 years. I mean almost all of church history, over 2,000 years, sex has been looked at as something that, yes, God allows it, but he allows it because it would repopulate the earth. But it was never intended by God to be fun or enjoyable or even feel good. And if it did feel good, you were supposed to feel guilty about that because that's not what it was supposed to be about. But can we stop for just a second? Can we just stop this nonsense? Can we just get real and admit this out loud? Sex feels good. Sex feels good. I know you can't believe I just said that, but sex feels good, and you're a liar if you say it doesn't. It's enjoyable and it's pleasurable. And here's what's going to really shock you. There's a reason for that, and it's a theological reason on top of that. Sex feels good because God is good, and He gives us good gifts with the intention that we enjoy His good gifts. That's why sex feels good. So God intends that we enjoy the gift of sex when it is the time and the place for a man and a woman to do so. I want to give you just even evidence outside of theology. Biology and human anatomy and physiology prove that God intends we have sex. God not only created us with the body parts to participate in intercourse with, but He made our bodies with the ability to climax. And that means He didn't just intend sex to be a reproductive act, but He also intends that it bring us pleasure. If sex was not supposed to be enjoyable, then why would God allow us to enjoy it? That wouldn't make any sense. God would have not done that. Now, with all that said, here's what we're going to do today. Just setting stage. We're going to go into the bedroom of Solomon and the Shulamite woman. They have done things the right way. They have restrained themselves sexually. They know that lust has burned hot within them, but they also knew that God ordained that sex happen within a monogamous covenantal relationship that we call marriage. And so they have chosen to pursue holiness rather than give in to their hormones, right? And they have chosen to pursue holiness rather than give in to their physical urges. So they have gotten married. This is where we were last week at their wedding. They got married at an epic wedding. Now it is the first night of their honeymoon, and they take us inside their suite at Sandals, Jamaica, or wherever they are. And they're going to give us an all-access pass and leave very, very little to the imagination. So I want to go ahead and just give you two more quick thoughts before we get into the text. And I don't want to hold you off too long. These are important little qualifying statements to help set up the way we're going to read the text. I think the anticipation of waiting only enhances the pleasure of sex. Listen, the first night of your honeymoon, whether you've waited or not, is pretty incredible. But it's especially incredible if you've done things the right way and restrained your lustful desires to that point. There is a build-up to it, an anticipation. And honestly, I have to go ahead and confess this. I can't imagine what that is like because that was not the case for us. And I'm ashamed of that. And maybe that feels like it's a little bit too personal for me to be sharing with you. But as I continue to tell you, I don't want to be this guy who stands up here and begs people to honor God by pursuing a sexual relationship in the way He intends, and then leave you with the impression that you should do that because I did, because I didn't. I can't tell you what it's like to have never known the sexual touch of a woman before you get married. But I can tell you this. I honestly, genuinely regret it with all of my heart. If you meet me for very long, you'll realize I'm a very no regrets person. But if I could invent a time machine, the one thing I'd do would be go back and undo any sexual encounters I had before marriage. Because honestly, they only ever created problems and wounds and images and memories that I wish I did not have. And you know what? I can't help but think that everybody in this room who has that same testimony as me would say the exact same thing. I would say that even if you're not a Christian yet, you're not sure what you think about Jesus, you would probably still say that very same thing. This is not Solomon and the Shulamite woman. I mean, just think about this, this scene. They drive to the airport after the reception. They board the plane. They catch a quick nap. They've landed in the islands. The resort picks them up in a limo and takes them directly to the honeymoon suite. And it is that time. Right, time to consummate the marriage, and they experience this weird mixture of nerves and adrenaline and the crazy release of hormones that they can't pronounce and they didn't even know that they had. And we're right here at this moment. I want to give you one more qualifying thought before we look at the text, and that is that the biblical ideal for sex is laid out in this text. We got to be really, really careful that we understand what it means that this is ideal sex. So before we get into this first night of the honeymoon, I want us to keep that in mind. That this is ideal sex. Now, have you ever noticed this? Many kind of just social commentators have noted that there is a ton of pressure on the first night of the honeymoon sex because in our culture, we've elevated it to this almost nirvana-like status. And while the first night all of us were together on our honeymoon, or maybe even just the first night we were together, if we can't say that we waited for our honeymoon, while it was awesome and wonderful, honestly, we couldn't help but feel that maybe we had done something wrong because it didn't quite live up to the hype, right? And that's not because you did anything wrong. The truth is that while all sex is an amazing gift of God, it would be almost impossible for it to live up to what we have made it out to be in our culture. So here's what I don't want you to do. I don't want you to read this if you're not married yet and expect that the first night of your honeymoon must match this or you're a failure. I also don't want you to read this if you're already married and think back to the first night of your honeymoon and think, wow, we were failures. I also don't want you to do this if you're already married. I don't want you to read this and assume that every single time you're together sexually in the bedroom as a husband and a wife, it must match the magic of what Solomon and the Shulamite woman share here. Can we just be honest? Sometimes it's just Tuesday night, and while you want to be together with your spouse, you're tired, right? You're worn out, and you want to be with them, but the truth is you don't have time to create chocolate fondue to dip strawberries in and shave your legs and put on his favorite lingerie, right? It's just time to do it and go to sleep. I mean, are you with me? So, I mean, we just need to be honest about that. And so this text, again, it is what God intends for ideal sex to be in an ideal setting. And while this ideal sex that we're going to see, this should be the goal that we're striving for, we need to be okay with the fact that we're not always going to live up to that. Okay, so with all that said, let's read our text. Song of Solomon chapter 4. We're going to go ahead and read all the way down through verse 15. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost its young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate, the heart behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David built in rows of stone. On it hang 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that graze among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will go away to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense. You are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Depart from the peak of Amana, from the peak of Senir and Hermon, from the dens of the lions, from the mountains of leopards. You have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your oils than any spice. Your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride, and a spring locked and a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates with all the choicest fruits, henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water and flowing streams from Lebanon. So let's just go ahead and do this. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you several observations, and you're going to notice that each one of those observations starts with this statement, biblical sex is, and then I give you the observation. So that's all I'm going to do today is just give you several observations from this text about what biblical marital ideal sex is. And the first of those is that it is a matter of the soul and not just the body. So we just got to start with this, that sex is not just sex with a body or a body part. Sex is with a person. And honestly, the sex that you have is as much with the soul of that person as it is with the body. Now, here's why all that's important. Because it slows us down. And it causes us to consider that there is another soul at stake in this encounter. And because we love that soul, we pledged in marriage to care for that soul. We don't just rush into what we want to do, but rather instead we focus on what is mutually beneficial for both of us at all times, including the bedroom. So realizing that you're having sex with not just a body, but a soul, it slows you down. Now, don't get me wrong. I wholeheartedly understand that you can have sex with just a body and that it will still feel somewhat good. But that kind of sex can't compare to the passionate release of emotion that you experience when you look at one another and you want to be together sexually, not just at a I find your body hot level, but rather I find your soul intoxicating level. Right? That's what we're trying to get at. In Song of Solomon chapter 4, verse 1, you notice that Solomon, he seems to be commenting on the appearance of his bride's eyes. But what's actually really going on is he's actually offering a commentary on her soul, on who she is. And we kind of understand this. We have our own expression that the eyes are the window to the soul. And this is what Solomon is doing. Yes, he's looking into her eyes, but really he's looking through her eyes. And what he is admiring in those moments is her soul, her character, her integrity, her kindness, her inner beauty. So this is what's really important to me. I think it's interesting. Before Solomon ever talks about her body, he delights in her person, in who she is, in her soul. And Solomon, I think he gets something that we so often miss. He gets that his bride is more than a body, but as a human, she is also a soul. And he wants to engage every part of who she is on their first night together as marriage partners. Because here's the truth. He had fallen in love with all of her, and not just the way she looked standing there in her bra and panties. Men, I am telling you something that you need to hear. Telling your woman that she is hot is okay, but whether she ever tells you this or not, she needs more than that. She needs to know that you approve of her more than, and you approve of her more than just her physical appearance. What she really needs to know is that you approve of who she is and that you delight in her character as much as you desire her body. Right? Solomon continues to survey her beauty in the first four verses. What's interesting to me in those first four verses is that he spends all of his time on what's above her neck. Isn't that interesting? And that tells us something, that he was not rough or in a hurry. He is taking his time. He is drinking in every part of who she is. And here's the result. This unlocks so much of her to him. And the passion that they feel and experience on this night, it is only heightened by his willingness to woo her, to want to have sex with him, rather than just assume that she has to have sex with him because it's their wedding night. Do you get what I'm trying to drive at here? He is pursuing her. He's in a sense trying to talk her into it. But he's trying to woo her to want to be with him rather than assuming that she should. I think what I guess if you just want an illustration of that, you know, his first line in verse 1, it's not, his first line isn't about her soul, and then the next thing out of his mouth is now let me help you off with that dress, right? That's not where he goes. If you remember back to the first chapter, this is very important for this gal specifically, because if you remember back to the very first chapter, this gal is a little bit insecure about her body. But you know what? Most women are. I've seen Angie naked, I mean, literally at this point, possibly thousands of times. And yet anytime I walk in the bathroom unannounced and she's getting dressed, I mean, she starts looking for stuff to cover up with. Like, you know what I mean? And it's not because she doesn't want me to see it. It's because she's insecure about it. Most women are much more insecure about their bodies than we as men will ever know. And honestly, they're much more secure about their bodies than most of the time they even know. Your wife never, ever tires of hearing that she is beautiful, that she still captivates you, that she still causes your heart to skip a beat when she walks into the room and she is all dolled up. And you need to hear me say this, man. Your wife will never fully give herself to you, and she will never fully enjoy being with you sexually unless you are able to help her feel confident in her body because she feels that you are content in her body. Right? Does that make sense? The women are nodding. Men are like, what? I've never heard this before. That's why we're having this sermon, right? Listen, she needs to know that you are content in her whole body. And you need to hear me say this, not just the parts that we sexualize. Her whole body, head to toe. And this is what Solomon is doing. And you need to never forget, here's the reason for all that. You need to never forget that on both parts in a sexual relationship, it requires deep vulnerability, but it really requires it for a woman. And the safer that you feel with one another, and especially the safer she feels with you, you're going to have a deeper level of pleasure, passion, and gratification as you embark on your sexual journey together. And so Solomon takes his time because he understands this, because he understands that there's more than the intertwining of bodies going on in biblical sex, but rather the union of two souls. Now the second observation is from verse 5, and it is that biblical sex is gentle and not hyper-aggressive. So in verse 5, he starts to move down her body. We can imagine him in these moments. He's moving down her body. He's kissing and slowly sliding down her. Her dress at this point is apparently half off, and he takes in her breast. Now, here's what you're going to do. You're going to dirty this up, and here's our problem. We are one of the very few cultures in the world that sexualize the breast the way we do. You may not realize this, but most cultures around the world, they see breasts more as a utility to feed children than as an erotic fantasy. And that's why when you're thumbing through a National Geographic or watching a documentary, you see a woman walking around topless, and while it's weird for you, it's not weird for them. Because for them, it's not the primary sexual object that we have made it here in America. Right? So this isn't as dirty as you might initially think. He compares her breasts to fawns, to baby deer, grazing in a meadow. Now, I'm not sure you should use that line when you're talking to your bride, or any of these lines, just to be honest with you, but you should get the point. So I think he's really making two comments in that. I think first he's commenting that she's presumably a young woman and her breasts are young and full of life, perky, we might say, without being dirty. More than that, I think what he's talking about is the gentleness with which he is going to approach her. Now think about this. If you want to convince a baby deer that you are its friend and to let you come over to and get it to come over to you and let you pet it, here's what you don't do. You don't run up to it, jump on its back, and start grabbing at it. What do? You slowly, gently approach it, and you stick your hand out, and you invite it to come close to you when it is ready to do so. The second thing you don't do is when that baby deer finally does come over, you don't squeeze the life out of it when they do finally get over there. You respond to their timidity with gentleness. And women are the same way. Women respond to gentleness. And men, we can't help it. I'm guilty. We know one speed in life, and that is wide open. So we all struggle with this. We all struggle with slowing down and being gentle. But can I just say this? Because maybe this is going to like speak some life into some of your sexual relationships. If your wife is not responding to your attempts to sort of warm her up for a sexual encounter, could it be that you've been handling her like you're getting ready to wrestle her for the World Heavyweight Championship at the next WrestleMania and she doesn't like it? Right? So here's a great word for men to learn. Caress. Caress your wife. And this is what Solomon is getting at in verse 5. He knows what his woman needs, and it is to be caressed, not groped. And there is a difference between the two. Now, there's a reason most men struggle with this tenderness thing and gentleness. It's because we've watched so much porn over the years that we have been trained to think that that's what sex is supposed to be like. And so all of a sudden, we get married and we start to have sex, and we just assume from what the actors and actresses on the screen have done, that's what sex is supposed to be. And what we do as a result is we wind up pornifying our own bedrooms. We watch those physical paid performances, and we assume that this is what God intends for sex, and this is a huge mistake. Look, I know I'm hitting you where it hurts. I'm just confessing. This is why my heart is so burdened to share this sermon, to talk about this subject from a biblical perspective, because I was sexually warped. Because what I learned about sex was not from my mom or dad or the Bible, but it was rather from porn. At 13 years old, that my friend's dad had recorded and didn't know we had found. And Matt Chandler comments in his book, Mingling of Souls, that porn makes men sexually stupid. And he's not being funny when he says that. Porn makes men sexually stupid. So man, I'm going to say this, and it's going to hurt a little bit. Your wife is not a whore. She's not your whore. She's not trapped in porn. She is not your sexual slave. Porn is about the base carnal male lust and appetite and the gratification of it. Sex is about mutual love between two people. Porn is about male lust. Sex in marriage is about love, the expression of love between two people. They could not be more different. And Solomon got that. So he's tender and he's slow and he's gentle with his new bride as he leads her sexually. Now in verse 6, here's what we see about biblical sex. Biblical sex builds upon itself, and it is not void of passion. I know what you're thinking. That's what the guys in the room are thinking. Great. You know, no passion here. But that does not mean that all of Solomon's gentleness and tenderness, and does not mean that he's robotic. He is passionate because sex is intense and passionate. It's not intellectual, right? You're not playing checkers, right? There's real feelings at stake here. He may have been restrained and wise during their time of foreplay, but he is definitely ready to go. He plans on enjoying himself with her, and this is how we know this. In verse 6, he speaks of the day breathing and the shadow fleeing. Basically, this is his way of saying, we don't have to rush because we are going to be at this all night, baby. We can go nice and slow because we ain't got no place to go, which is basically the script for every Boys to Men song ever. But anyway, right? You get what I'm saying? So this is what we're getting at. And I think that he's hinting here that this is going to be a lot of fun from him. He describes himself as climbing mountains of perfume and riches and then resting when he reaches the top. He's ready to enjoy himself. This isn't devoid of passion. And without being inappropriate, I need to say this, because I know maybe this is on your mind. Who knows if Solomon actually had the stamina to do what he's describing here? Fundamentally, what he said is more important than his plans and whether or not he could accomplish them. The point for him is that he is in this moment. God has placed a sexual fire for his new wife in his heart, and that flame has been stoked to a raging point. And while he knows this moment will have to end at some point, daybreak if he's lucky and can live up to his promises, the point is he doesn't want it to ever end. That's what he's trying to communicate. I want to stay here forever. I wish we never had to leave this moment right here. Right? So, this is no wham, bam, thank you, ma'am moment. Solomon is locked in on his wife. He loves her. He is intoxicated by her. And he is 100% undistracted, and he wants to stay there forever. Sex is supposed to build up to a crescendo. Right? And this is why foreplay is a real thing. It's not dirty. It's real because sex is a buildup. We must work our way into it. Right? Now, I get it, man. We're like a push lawnmower. One pull of the crank and we are ready to go. And I'm not meaning that dirty. I'm just saying that's the way we are. Our engines rev up really quickly. But your wife is not like that. Right? She's like an old Ford in the middle of the Alaska winter. You got to crank the engine and let it run for a little while before it's warm enough to actually get in and drive. Right? Do you follow where I'm trying to go? This is who your wife is. So we got to build ourselves into it. And you know what else is important to me to say? Rushing through sex as a married couple, you know what it really says? You don't want to be there. I'm not saying you wish you were somewhere else. Right? I'm not accusing you of that. I'm just saying that you don't really want to be there in those moments. Maybe you just want to get it over with and go to sleep. Maybe we're physically present, but as men, our minds are on the ball game. Or maybe we're both thinking about and stressing out about some project at work that we have to get to first thing in the morning. But for whatever reason, any number of reasons, we may be there, but we're not present. You know what I mean? We're there, but we're not really present. And this is not Solomon. He is with her. And he does not want this moment to end. And they are building up. He is locked in on her with a laser focus. And he has nothing on his mind at that moment but his bride and the night that lay ahead of them. In verse 7, I think what we see is that biblical sex does not dwell on the fringes of what might be considered wrong or right. I've done a lot of premarital counseling over the years. Primarily, most of my ministry has been with people in their 20s and late teens. So I've done a lot of premarital counseling. And I'm going to be honest with you, I've been asked some really weird questions, especially in the sexual realm. As I've done that. Now, I'm not sure the first time that I was asked about role play and imagining other people while you have sex together, but I remember in that moment, the first time I was asked, like thinking it was wrong, kind of feeling it was wrong, but not being able to biblically articulate why it was wrong. Right? So I just want to say this. I've come to realize that at least one of the reasons why it's wrong is that it's essentially adultery. If you take Jesus's words about even looking at a woman with lustful intent, looking at another woman, imagining another woman, looking at her with lustful intent in your heart as being adultery, then you can't really argue that role play and fantasizing about other people would not be adultery. But you know, there's another reason for it, and it's right here in Song of Solomon chapter 4, because it's doing something with your body sexually that you don't feel with your soul. Right? Do you get that? It's being there, but not being present. And it doesn't even matter if a couple agrees that they want to do some of those types of things. Because that's sometimes the argument people want to make. Well, yeah, but we both enjoy it, so. I mean, Angie and I both enjoy eating a tub of ice cream. That's not good for us, right? I mean, that's a terrible argument for why you should do something. So yes, this may sound strange to you. Even Christians who are married can have sex in a way that steals the soul right out of sex. Does that make sense? And you can be guilty of having sex in a way that is in the lust and the passion of the Gentiles, as Paul describes in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 15. But this is not Solomon. He is at the cusp of the launch of the festivities in verse 7. I love that he references her. I don't know if you caught this. She is altogether beautiful. That tells us that she is now completely naked. And Solomon is blown away. Now, many commentators on this passage have pointed out that a woman in this day, she would have worn a neck-to-toe dress that was nowhere close to form-fitting. She would have worn very loose clothes. And for that reason, that would mean that Solomon, I know you're thinking like, well, okay, well, I mean, really, this guy's kind of going overboard. But he really, in these moments, he has had no idea about the shape and the curve of her breast. He's had no idea about the curves of her figure. He really didn't know how much junk was in the trunk, right? Just kidding. Okay, sorry. Couldn't help myself. She's standing there and she is naked and her stomach must be exploding and all these butterflies. And Solomon puts all those nerves to rest because he takes her by the hand with a thirst and a hunger for her in his eyes. And he tells her that in all ways she is altogether beautiful. He is totally hypnotized by her. In other words, you read the end of Genesis chapter 2, the very last verse, they are naked and there is no shame. There's no shame. This is what God intends for a man and a woman to be in the bedroom. They are not dabbling on the edges of what might be considered right or wrong biblically for sex. They know in this moment that what they are doing is good and right and that God would give them his thumbs up. Right? That's important. They are not ashamed of what they're doing because they know what they're doing is 100% on target, in the center of the target, right in the eyes of God. And this is what's always concerning to me when people start talking to me about needing all those other things that are on the fringes of what might be right or wrong to spice up their sex life. The problem in those moments is not what they're doing, but the problem is why they need to do them to enjoy their spouse. Right? That's the point. So verse 8 down through 11, we see that biblical sex is enjoyable. And it's part, not all, but part of what makes a marriage go next level. In verse 8, it sounds like Solomon's kind of going out of his mind. He references faraway peaks and wild animals. Now, I think two things are being communicated with those words. First, there is a ferocity to the way he desires her that probably mirrors the instincts within wild animals. The second thing that it means is that these words are descriptive of an encounter that they feel like is literally transporting them. They are climbing to new heights in their relationship, and poetically, Solomon feels as if he is being taken to another place as he stands in the presence of his naked bride. Right? He tells her repeatedly to come with him in those verses. I don't know if you caught that. He tells it repeatedly. He's ready. Come with me. It's time. Right? That's what he's trying to say. He wants her to follow his lead, and together he intends that they go together to new places of joy and bliss that up to this point have been unreachable in their relationship. Now here's what most of you are thinking. Man, this all sounds good, but the truth is all sex for us just doesn't always feel that moving. Remember, I want to point out again, this is ideal sex. But from time to time, can I say this? I hope that maybe not this is not every encounter you have, but I hope you have some that are this way. I mean, from time to time, and hopefully fairly often, you and your spouse are really in sync spiritually, emotionally. You're connecting in ways that are bigger than you can sometimes put into words, and that leads you hand in hand into the bedroom. And it may be sex that happens in those moments, but it is not sex as usual because there is something bigger going on, something bigger going on than our standard is Saturday night and we haven't had sex in a week, so I guess we better do it, right? You should have those moments where you literally are so in sync that you are almost kind of going and climbing to new heights in your relationship. Think about what Solomon says in verses 9 through 11. He's gorging himself on her love. He's intoxicated or drunk on their passion. I love Solomon doesn't hold anything back. He wildly throws himself into their time together. He is determined to squeeze every square inch of ecstasy out of their sex as possible. Now, maybe for you, that sounds like it came out of a cheesy, cheap romance novel. You know, one of those that I used to see on the shelves at Walmart. You know, it's got like a guy with his shirt off and a woman with her dress falling off. And there's always a horse in the background for some reason. I don't know why equine or, you know, intoxicating or sexual, but whatever. Maybe that sounds like it's from there. This is out of the Bible. I mean, is this not astounding? Like you're sitting here thinking like, dude, like you know, Nicholas Sparks isn't this sappy, right? But this is out of the Bible, out of the Word of God. Solomon and the Shulamite woman, this is why we can talk about this free of shame, because they're not doing anything that's shameful, right? This is what God ordains and commands, and that means that when sex is done right, and this is where we go with our next thing, when sex is done right in the right context, it's holy. It's not pornographic. You know, holy is best defined as being set apart. If I just had to define that word, it means to be utterly distinct and different from all others, and I would just agree that generally, the word holy should be a word that is reserved for only God. But I think biblical sex, sex in the confines of marriage, is holy because it's ministering to the temple of God. It is sex in marriage between two believers is ministering to the temple of God. Now, I know that sounds weird, but let me explain. In verses 12 through 15, Solomon repeatedly, he kind of compares her body, his bride's body, to a secret dream garden, a garden that was formerly forbidden. That's the idea. This was formerly forbidden, but now it's open for him to enjoy and for just him to enjoy. Right? So let's see if we can kind of unpack this thought. Solomon, by the way, he built this enormous, uber blinged out temple for the Jews, which the Jews worshiped God. You can read about that in 1 Kings chapter 6. In that temple was a very special room called the Holy of Holies. And this is where the Ark of the Covenant, and this Ark represented the actual presence of God on earth to the Jews. And the Ark of the Covenant rested in the Holy of Holies. Only one person, this is where we kind of get to where the rubber meets the road, so kind of stay with me. Only one person was ever allowed to go in there, and that was the high priest, and he could only go once a year. And when he went, he was only going to sprinkle the blood of a sacrifice. Now, imagine for just a second having the honor of being the one guy in Israel who got to go into the Holy of Holies. It'd be scary, right? You can read some of the Old Testament history and realize what would happen if you went in there not prepared and with a clean heart. So it would be scary, but at the same time, it would be exhilarating as you walked into this room, because you would know in those moments you were seeing something and experiencing something that no one else you would ever know would be able to see and experience. It would be for just you. Think about that. I want to be careful here. I don't want to compare sex and marriage to sprinkling the blood of atonement in the Holy of Holies, but I do think there are some minor parallels. Solomon is the first person and probably the only person he knows that will ever see what he is seeing that night and ever experience what he is experiencing that night. She is a secret garden that is now a formerly forbidden place that has now been opened to him. And not because he forced it open, but because he did the hard work and he's been invited in by his wife and by God to enjoy the fruits of her body in marital sex. Now, I also bring all this up, the Holy of Holies and the Ark of Covenant and the presence of God, because of something we're told in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Now, we're going to flip there, and I want to take just a second and apologize to you that we don't use our Bibles enough. We preach from the Bible. I don't think that's ever debatable, but we make a lot of references, but I rarely ask you to turn. We need to turn. We need to see these verses so that you know I'm not making this up or manipulating some translation that we throw up on the screen. So if you want to take just a second and turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I want to read verses 18 and 19 to you. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I want to read verses 18 and 19. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own. And so what does Paul essentially get at in 1 Corinthians chapter 6? That we should flee or do all that we can to stay away from sexual immorality. And why? Because our bodies are the new temples of God. This presence of God that symbolically used to rest in the Holy of Holies and in the Ark of the Covenant now literally rests in us. When we trust Jesus, God sends His Spirit to dwell and live within us. Now, Paul writes this, and when he writes this letter, the last Jewish temple had been ransacked. The temple of Solomon had been destroyed at some point. They rebuilt it. And the next Jewish temple they built, the last one that was ever built, has been ransacked after the Jews tried to launch some sort of civil rebellion against Roman occupation in 70 AD. The Romans came in and totally destroyed it. And Paul says that doesn't matter. The loss of the temple in Jerusalem doesn't matter, because now our bodies are the resting place, are the dwelling place of the presence of God. Now, this is where it gets good. That means that sex is a holy activity when it's done in marriage between two followers of Jesus, because it involves the temple of God. You've never thought of that, have you? That sex in marriage between two followers of Jesus is literally, when you do that, you are engaging with the temple and the resting place of God. His temple. And that makes sex, when done in a way that God commands, a holy act and an act of worship. That means that God's rules, if you will, for sex in general, these are rules for engagement with His temple. That's what it is. And when we obey those with glad hearts, and we do that cheerfully, we are worshiping God. And this is the second way that sex is holy. Because sex in marriage is not just a sacred act, right? Just like the kind of entering the Holy of Holies. It's not just a sacred act, but it's an act of worship, or at least it should be, because here's what sex should do. It should draw our attention to the goodness of God. It should draw our attention to the goodness of God. As I stated in the beginning of the sermon, He created sex, and He created it to be good. And he created our bodies with the ability to experience orgasms. When we enjoy any pleasure in life, be it sex or a good meal, these pleasures are meant to remind us of how good God is to gift them to us. And they also should make us think about how awesome the eternal pleasures that God has in mind for us when sin is no longer present must be if we can extract this much joy and happiness and pleasure out of his gifts on the earth that is wrecked and stained by sin. Can you imagine? If we can extract this much joy from right now in a world that is broken and wrecked by sin, can you imagine how good the eternal pleasures of God must be when sin is no longer present? As weird as it sounds to hear, sex is indeed holy when it's done by a man and a woman in marriage with the intent of only ministering to one another and worshiping God. So I'm going to give you just a couple of next steps, really briefly. I want you to eliminate everything from your marriage bed that hinders your sex life, including your kids. This is going to sound really weird for me to say and for you to hear. I want you to have lots of sex. I want you to eliminate everything from your marriage bed that hinders your sex life. And I think that starts with some honest conversations about your sex life with your spouse. Seriously, you need to ask them, what do you like about it? What do you wish is better than it currently is? How many, you need to ask how you may have unintentionally did them wrong somewhere in their sexual relationship or in your sexual relationship. You need to ask how you can serve them better as a sexual partner in your marriage going forward. In addition to that conversation, if you're a man and woman in marriage, I want you to have frequent, mutually serving, gentle, biblical sex as often as your schedule allows you this week and every other week after that, by the way. Basically, I want you to enjoy one another. And listen, here's what that's going to mean. It's going to mean some changes in your routine and your schedule. Some of you are going to have to stop watching so much television. Some of you are going to have to put down your phones and get off Facebook. Some of you are going to have to stop being so obsessed with your favorite sports team. You're going to have to choose to be with your wife or your husband. I think some of you are going to have to deal with the fact, and this is going to hurt some feelings, that you've made the mistake of allowing your kids to occupy your marriage bed like Wall Street protesters. And now you can't get them out. You're not going to like this, but kick them out. That bed is for you and for your wife or your husband, not your kids. Now, maybe there's a medical reason, and short of that, that's what I'm saying. If you have a medical reason, your child has a need to be in the bed. I'm not saying it's simple to ever let them be in the bed with you, but I'm talking about people who have not had sex in years because it's really hard to do it when your three-year-old's between you. They need to go. I know they want to sleep in the bed with mommy. I know they do. I got three boys. They don't want to ever take showers, wear shoes, or do their homework. But our job as a parent is to be a parent. And that means sometimes making decisions that are unpopular with our kids. But I think it also means that we not only always do what's best for them, but sometimes we have to make decisions that are best for us and for our marriage as well. And that's okay. That's okay. I know you can't believe I just said all this. And that's okay. But listen, you need to hear that it is okay for you to sometimes put your needs and your wants ahead of your kids. And since this is usually a bigger problem for ladies, let me explain it this way. You are not just a mother. You are a woman with all the needs and desires and wants that come with being a woman. And I get it. Maybe it seems noble to put all of your needs and your wants on the back burner to attempt to be super mom to your kids. I get it. But can I tell you it's unhealthy? It's unhealthy for you in the long run, and it is definitely unhealthy for your marriage in the short and long run. And maybe you don't get motivated to do this because, can I tell you this? Maybe you can deal with it. Maybe you can deal with putting the natural needs and wants that come of being a woman aside for a season of life and focus on being a mother. But if you do that, that means you're neglecting your husband. And not only are you a woman and a mother, you're also a wife. And you can read 1 Corinthians. Please jot this down. I'm not going to do it today because we're going to run out of time. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 2 and 5, if you don't believe that what I'm about to tell you is true. But being a man's husband comes with responsibilities. You have responsibilities sexually to that strapping hunk of a man you married all those years ago. And by the way, you married him with the intention of sharing your marriage bed and all the passion that goes with that with him alone forever when you married him, when you said, I do, didn't you? And now, you got this guy in your bed, and every time he rolls over to caress your body, he collides with some two-year-old with a booger-infested blankie. And that two-year-old, he's now your new cuddle partner rather than your husband. Because your husband's probably a good man and a good father, he hardly ever complains about it, but I'm going to say what they won't say to you. He hates it. He hates that he has to share the one place and the one time of the day that he's supposed to have alone with his wife, with his children. And more than that, he hates that he feels that way. He begins to feel shame for even feeling that way. But he feels it all the same. Kids have no place in the marriage bed. And it's okay if you disagree with me, but I promise you. Because here's what you're thinking. You're thinking, man, to lay in the bed with my child is so moving, it's so fulfilling when they wake up and they stroke your cheek and they smile. But I'm going to tell you, that is a lousy, lousy replacement for the gentle caress and the passionate kiss and the intimate embrace of your husband who hungers to enjoy you and bring pleasure to you as you enjoy him. That 2-year-old is a lousy replacement for your husband. And I got to believe that deep down inside, you're a good mom and you won't ever say this, but you want that kid out of the bed as bad as your husband does. Because you know deep down that that child can't take the place of your husband, no matter how cute he or she is. I'm not being a jerk. Seriously, look at me. I'm not being a jerk. I'm not trying to be that guy. I'm asking and pastorally pleading with you to eliminate all the things from your life that are hindering you from fully enjoying the gift of your spouse and sex with them. And if that includes kids or even dogs, by the way, sleeping in bed with mommy and daddy, then they need to go too. They need to go. After all that, the second thing I want you to do is I want you to spend every time together, every day, some time together every day as a couple, and I want you to thank God for not just the gift of sex and not just the gift of marriage and not just the gift of your spouse, but rather the gift of sex in marriage with your spouse. I think that's probably catching you off guard. I mean, you would get that I would ask you to thank God for sex as a couple or maybe to thank God for your spouse. But I want you to not only just thank God for the gift of sex, I want you to thank him for the gift of marriage. You see, not only is sex from the mind of God, but so is marriage. This is just one more of his good gifts. And you think about this. God could have given us the gift of sex. I really want you to think about this for 2 seconds. God could have given us the gift of sex without commanding that we get married. But here's what the result would have been. That would have been a disaster, and our enjoyment of sex in those moments would have been minimized. Sex would have not been as good because sex outside of marriage is shallow and stressful. It's shallow in the joy that it brings because it comes without the covenantal promise of lifelong commitment. Missing that promise of lifelong commitment, it puts a cap or a ceiling, if you will, on the joy that we can experience in sex. I think sex outside of marriage is also less enjoyable because it's stressful. Because sex outside of marriage comes with all having to worry about all these what ifs. What if he doesn't call me tomorrow after we do this? Right? What if I get pregnant? What if she gets pregnant? What if my girlfriend finds out? What if our parents find out? What if he or she has a disease? And I catch it. I could go on, but I think you kind of get the point. The momentary physical pleasure that you feel in sex outside of marriage always quickly gives way to this crippling mental stress and all these feelings of guilt and shame and regret. Because deep down, if you're here today, you've been raised probably to somewhat know who Jesus is and know the commands of the Bible, and you get that you are doing something wrong. And all of this limits our joy in sex. But in marriage, we don't have to worry about all the what ifs, do we? All the what ifs that come along with it, or at least we don't have to worry about them the same way as we do before marriage. We don't have to stress about whether or not my wife or husband's going to hang around after this is over. We don't have to stress if we get pregnant. That's okay, because there's somebody there to help pay for and raise these children. And I know divorce happens and can make what I'm talking about tricky, but I don't think any of us could deny that sex, that marriage uncomplicates our sexual relationship. And it frees us up to fully enjoy it, free of all the shallowness and stress that come otherwise. You know what else there is? There's no feelings of guilt and shame and regret. Because we know that when we are together as a man and woman sexually in marriage, if we take the Bible seriously, we are obeying God. And that makes it an act of worship. And it pleases him. And that only maximizes our joy in sex rather than inhibiting it. Do you get what I'm talking about? I don't want you to just thank God for the good gift of sex. And I don't want you to thank him just for the good gift of marriage or your spouse. I want you to thank him that he gave you all three. Because all three maximize the joy you feel in all of these things. Right? So spend time together each day in prayer, thanking God not just for sex, but the gift of sex and marriage with your spouse. Can I just encourage you? Listen, cultivate that habit, just in general. Cultivate the habit of thanking God for the good things in your life. And as a side note, can I say this as Austin comes up? I want you to hear me say this. This is really, really important. Not only, as you've always heard, not only does the couple that prays together stay together, but I think the couple that prays together stays in the bedroom together. Because there is nothing more intoxicating and alluring to me than to hear my wife lift me up to Jesus. Because she knows me like nobody else knows me. And she is lifting me up to Jesus and lifting up my heartfelt, soul-level needs that most of you will never know about. And there's something that happens in those moments that draws us closer together and makes me want her like nothing else. So if you don't get anything else out of this sermon, even if you don't want to thank God for the gift of sex, for the gift of marriage, the gift of your spouse, and the gift of all three combined because it maximizes your joy in sex, would you spend some time praying together with your spouse this week? If you don't do anything else, pray together. And I promise you the result will be that your hearts will be drawn closer together. If you're not married yet, take notes, brothers. Take notes, sisters. You're right? Odds are pretty good. I know it doesn't feel like it right now. We've all been there. The odds are pretty good you're going to be married one day. And yeah, it's easy to dismiss it and say, well, I'll worry about that when I get there. Well, you know, that's not always a very good idea. That's like, you know, driving to New Orleans and thinking I'll get a hotel when I get there. That usually doesn't work out. You call ahead of time. You make plans, right? Well, make plans for your sexual relationship and your marriage. Listen, this is all I want to end with. I just want to pray for you really quickly that today, being here today, has served you well. I want to pray that Jesus is glorified in all of our lives, including the way we go about our sexual relationship as marriage partners. And I want to apologize because I know that this sermon has probably been probably as empty of an explicit sort of, I hate to use the word presentation of the gospel, but it's the only thing I know to say. It's been as empty and devoid of a clear, explicit presentation of the gospel as maybe any sermon that I've ever preached. So I want to apologize to you for that. But I felt just so compelled to share with you honestly about this matter. And the text did not easily make it easy to sort of try to draw connections to the gospel. But I do want to share with you this as we wrap up. Your only shot of doing all the things that I've talked about is a surrendered, sold out, radically devoted relationship to Jesus. Because here's why. And I can't speak for the women in the room. I can speak about women and my experiences with my own wife. You're never going to fully submit to this until you're fully submitted to Jesus. Because really at the end of the day, sex is about the gospel. It's about the gospel. It's about laying what you want for your body down so that others can have what they could not have otherwise, so that they could have joy that they could not have otherwise. If that doesn't sound like Jesus, I don't know what does. Men, sex is about sacrifice. It's about leading. It's about nurturing. It's about pursuing in the same way that you've been pursued and nurtured and sought by Jesus. At the end of the day, sex is about the gospel, and that's why you have no shot at having what's been described here, short of a thriving, budding relationship with Jesus. So Austin's going to sing. I don't know where to go from here. We challenge you with next steps. Maybe just ponder those, pray together as a couple. If you need to know Jesus because you know you have no shot at this, please come see me. I'm going to be sitting right here. I'm not standing. I'm sitting. The invitation is open. Please come see me. And if you can't talk to me now, I'm wearing these clothes. I live next door. Come find me. Okay? I love you guys. Let me pray for us and turn it over to Austin. Father, in Jesus' name, I pray for the marriages represented here. That, Father, they would be fully surrendered to your word. They would be fully surrendered to Jesus. And that they would realize right now they will never live up to what's laid out in this text unless they are fully surrendered to Jesus. The gospel is the only motivation that they will ever find to really, really, really have the kind of sexual relationship that's been laid out here. Free their minds from this nonsense that sex is dirty, that sex is wrong, that sex is about reproduction. Free their minds from this, and Father, awaken their hearts and open their minds to the idea that even in sex, they can put the gospel on display. I pray that over them in Jesus' name.